Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Alexander Maksik, whose latest novel is A Marker to Measure Drift. First novel was called You Deserve Nothing. Alexander Maksik has been a teacher in various places, including Iowa City, and we'll talk a little about that. This book in particular concerns a woman named Jacqueline, who is, we don't know at first, but later on we discover, a refugee from Liberia, trying to survive on the island of Santorini, one of the Greek islands, and we learn about her past and her present. I understand that this particular book began when you saw a black man in Italy. What's the story behind the origins of A Marker to Measure Drift?
I think I would go back earlier than that, having always been interested in immigrant stories, both in literature, but also mostly just in my experience, you know, living in California for a long time, and then later living in Europe, particularly in Paris, where I was struck by the sort of segregation in that city. I don't know why exactly I was so struck by it, but I know that I had unrealistic notions of what Paris was. So I began spending a lot of time in the north of Paris and in neighborhoods where there are a lot of West African and North African immigrants. But it's true that I was visiting my girlfriend in the north of Italy, and she was studying, and I had a lot of time on my hands, and was sitting in a garden every morning doing my own work, and this man came day after day, and he was the only black man that I'd seen in the region, and there was something about him that struck me. I never spoke with him, but it began, I guess, as many stories do, imagining the life of this person.
So what did you think he was?
I had no idea. My guesses, I suppose, were informed by the people who I knew in Paris and the stories that I'd heard in Paris. But I really had no idea. In the strange way that fiction becomes fiction, this novel is a result of that imagining, I suppose.
So at this point, You Deserve Nothing had been written, not published because you couldn't get it.
That's
published.
Right.
So
That's
you began
right.
working on this other book.
Yeah.
Somehow, this black man in Italy transmogrified into Jacqueline.
Yeah. I think of that moment, you know, those few days in Italy as the seed of this book. But, you know, it is in no way based on anyone I know or even on an individual person that I saw.
At some point, you began writing a book, but you had multiple stories in the book. You had the story of Jacqueline and a story of a French-American couple?
That's right, yeah. And I was sort of originally the idea was I would go back and forth between these two stories and really tell two separate stories. They would have nothing to do with each other, except for these three characters would intersect occasionally. And in reading, I have a friend to whom I read everything I write aloud, and she said, look, I hate to tell you this, but I don't care about this couple, and I'm far more interested in Jacqueline. And I came to agree that part of it wasn't working, and so I killed that couple off.
Which point, when you were left with Jacqueline, did you have what we see today, or did that have to be expanded? How did that work?
Oh, it was much expanded. I think part of that alternating story, the advantage is that when I ran out of material, when I ran out of ideas, I would just drop one character and move on to the other character. So by cutting that couple, I lost, you know, essentially half of the novel.
So you had a kind of look at Jacqueline through another light.
Right.
At that point, you still had her wandering the island.
Yes, yeah.
Somewhere along the line, you had to make a decision where she was from. You knew she was a refugee from a war, I would guess.
Yes, yeah.
And at that point, you kind of figured, what, because they speak English in Liberia?
Well, I mean, I knew that she was Liberian from the beginning, but I originally was going to write about someone from Senegal. But the problem with that was that he or she would have to speak French, and I didn't want to do that. So I started looking at, you know, at West African countries, English-speaking West African countries, and I came across Liberia in my research and began reading about the history of the country and found it compelling and strange and fascinating, and that's sort of that's where it began.
And you saw a film called Liberia, An Uncivil War.
Yes, yeah, which was deeply moving and very, it had a great impact on me.
What is the background in Liberia for listeners who don't really know much about Liberia?
To begin with, I'm by no means an expert on Liberia. But what I found originally, what I found most compelling, is this notion that it's a, you know, that it's a country essentially colonized by the United States and colonized by former American slaves, and the idea that, you know, they became the aristocracy in this country, and the country was formed by former slaves, I found quite strange and compelling, and that was really the seed.
And Charles Taylor was the president / dictator,
yes.
And there was a revolution against him.
That's right, yeah. And Jacqueline escapes, you know, the second civil war when Taylor is driven out of the country and, you know, only months before he is arrested.
You obviously never went there.
No, I didn't.
But you have been to Santorini.
Yes.
And you said it there because of its history as, quote, Atlantis?
Yeah, but for a variety of reasons. I mean, partly because I know it so well, partly because it has that strange combination of a kind of a horrible tourist island that is jam-packed with people pouring off of cruise ships. It's also incredibly pristine and beautiful in parts, but the beauty is created out of total destruction. And, you know, a lot of these cliffs, a lot of the views where people gather to watch the sunset are there because the volcano blew up.
Is it possible, using your novel as kind of a tour guide, mm-hmm. to actually follow Jacqueline's steps through the island?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm sure that I've made some errors in terms of the geography, but I tried not to.
You've said about A Marker to Measure Drift, Alexander Maksik, you've said the novel is about the interplay between two modes of existence, memory and present life. Mm-hmm. I'd like you go into that a little bit more and how that formed the way the novel speaks to us.
The idea, anyway, is that especially when Jacqueline is alone, she is immediately has what I refer to as present need. She needs to feed herself. She needs to find shelter. She needs to find a place to wash and so on. And while she is occupied by these immediate problems, she can keep memory at bay. But whenever there is leisure time, of which she has a great deal, she's haunted by memory. Especially when these memories are so awful, not exclusively, but she's recovering from a tremendous trauma. So I guess I saw that as a kind of battle, as a kind of war. While she needs desperately to eat, the absence of food allows her an escape from memory that haunts her.
And the memories that haunt her, you know, all along in the shaping of the novel, I guess this was probably even in the very early drafts, where it was heading, and
yeah.
that we as readers would be anticipating
right.
the discovery.
Right, and, you know, the conclusion of the novel, I never intended for it to be a great surprise or some tremendous revelation to the reader. I expect that the reader gathers in one way or another what this trauma is. For me, the conclusion really is the telling of the story, and that's the point.
Throughout the book, we hear her dead mother in her head.
Yes.
Was that always there?
Yes.
When you expanded, what did you exactly expand?
I went deeper into her character, but also the journey itself from one end of the island to the other end of the island and the various obstacles that she has to overcome in that journey.
There is a strong political element to the novel, of course. You said in an interview in Guernica magazine, "I'm not a publicly political person, but I feel my work should always be political, should be a response to the wide world." Can mm-hmm. you go into that a little bit more? And is that just you? What do you see in terms of the novel as a whole?
I use that word political in the most general sense. I'm not really interested in making an argument about novels in general, but I do use writing as a way to respond to the things that I see in the course of a day, whether that means reading the newspaper or walking down the street. And the more I write, the more I feel that my writing should be, in one way or another, a response to the world.
Why?
Partly because I guess I've always written and I've used writing as a way to keep myself present, to keep myself aware. And I've always felt that this is the closest I can come to responding in a positive way to what makes me angry, to what confuses me, to what makes me furious. I can't read the paper and be furious and, you know, throw things against the wall or whatever my response may be in a given day and then do nothing. For better or for worse, I don't think I'm going to start a revolution. I've been to very few protests in my life. I don't write letters. And this feels to me the most authentic response.
Some people say that the greatness of a novel, of fiction, is that it changes people through the back door.
Right. And that's what I hope. And I myself have been changed by art so frequently. And the way I feel reading a very good story in which I come to understand, to know a character, that intensity of feeling, that ability, you know, to provide a sense of empathy is something that I value a great deal. And I'm really writing as a way of asking questions. And I have no interest in answering those questions as a writer. It's all I know to do in response to the things that I see.
How conscious are you then of themes as you're writing?
I'm not conscious at all. And I'm terrified. I would never sit down and say, all right, I'm going to write a story that deals with these themes. That seems like death. That seems like nothing but trouble. You know those stories when you read them, where there's primarily an argument being made, and it's only after that argument is made that you discover that there might be a character, you know. And those are the kinds of stories I used to write, you know, the sort
really?
Of character on a soapbox. I mean, not that I ever published.
When did you write those?
Oh, I mean, from the time I was, you know, I think when I was in college, I was trying to write stories that made arguments, and it's just not the business of fiction.
Well, you studied Chekhov with Gurganis, with Alan Gurganis, who I've interviewed a couple of times.
Yeah,
great guy.
He's a lovely guy.
Great guy. And he taught you about, as you said in an interview, the nature of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do empathy? I mean,
I don't know that I do, but, you know, the most convincing argument that he made, and I think I've talked about this a little bit, I understood sort of intellectually that, you know, empathy is an important element of writing fiction. But I didn't really know it. I didn't understand it as a writer until I took his class. You know, he said humiliate no one. That was a line that I walked out of that class with, you know, that spring. And that resonated in a way that nothing else had resonated.
What do you think he meant by that?
It means that no one is one thing. There's no such thing as a pure villain. There is no such thing as a purely good character. You know, I think his argument essentially was, you know, be a good Christian as a writer.
As a writer.
As a writer, you know. I mean, you have to love everyone, and you have to be generous, and you have to forgive all of your characters. And your job is to present characters that are many things at once.
Sort of being aware, I guess, that every character is a hero in his or her own novel.
I suppose that's right.
In talking about that, you said that irony, glibness, and detachment are adolescent, and sincerity and love require more courage. What about sentimentality?
Well, that's the line you have to walk. Of course, I think sentimentality is as terrible a sin as sort of pure glibness and sarcasm and detachment. But that's why I think writing fiction is so hard. Because the question is, how can you be sincere? How can you inject feeling into your work without preaching, without becoming sentimental? That, for me, is the kind of fundamental question, is how do I take the way I feel, the way I respond to the world, and, you know, that can be to a, you know, to the end of a relationship or to a war I read about. But how do I take that feeling and turn it to fiction?
Before we move on to other parts of your life and your first novel, a few more questions. You went through 12 drafts of this book. How do you figure out a draft on a computer?
When it was finished, I would print it and work on it by hand. And then I would go back and in the early drafts, retype it, you know, from scratch. I don't know anymore what counts as a draft, but, you know, on my computer, I have 12 different documents, each, with a different draft number.
In terms of working on it, I understand that you edited things mm-hmm. down, which I know is something that people don't get, but
yeah.
less is usually more.
Yeah, certainly that's my attitude.
Were you looking for things like ensuring empathy, removing sentiment or irony?
I think I approached it from the point of view of character, it's Jacqueline's novel. Was she whole enough? Was she complete enough? Was her story layered enough? And, was her relationship with her sister, with her mother, with her father, were those relationships satisfying enough?
It sounds as if you did have what they called the voice of the book
yes.
early on,
yeah,
even in
absolutely.
That early draft. You knew what it was.
Yes, I did. And I don't know exactly how that came to be, but that was the most satisfying part of writing this book.
Well, I know that in talking to other writers that, once they find the voice,
yeah.
it's like
yeah.
something clicks.
Right. It's sort of tricky territory. There is something mysterious about it. In my experience, but you start talking about the mystery of where the voice came from, and you start sounding like you're a little unhinged, or you imagine yourself to be a genius.
A lot of writers talk about a character taking off and doing their own thing mm-hmm. in some sense, and other writers have said that's a load of bourgeois. How do you feel about that?
I think that if you know a character well enough, then you know what that character will do. Whether or not that means that the character is guiding the book, I think that ends up really being a semantic conversation. The real question for me anyway is, do I know this character well enough? And if I do, then I ask the character, essentially, where does the character go? What does the character do given a particular obstacle, for example? Now, I realize that I'm the one providing the obstacle. But if I provide the obstacle and I know the character well enough, then the character more or less makes the decision.
Well, toward the end of the book, there's another character, Katerina.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how did you feel about that? Was that just as easy or hard, or was she just merely a sounding board?
I don't think that I know her as well as I know Jacqueline. I mean, there's no question. I was wary of just making her a sort of sounding board, as you say. I didn't want her to be a sort of paper cutout and just be there as a device. I think about her and I like the idea of her existing on that island. And, it's not really for me to say what happens to the two of them.
Their relationship is a key point in Jacqueline coming to grips with her past.
Sure. Of yeah. course, and absolutely, it's an authorial device. I put Jacqueline in that restaurant. I had her come back, and I had this waitress be who she is. She didn't, descend from heaven and land on my desk. I knew that Jacqueline was going there from the beginning. I knew that that's where she was headed. I knew there would be a waitress there. I didn't know what she would be like until I got her there. And I think writers do go by feel, and there is not an absolute science and there's not a satisfying explanation other than, we get one character here and this is who she meets, and why that is, I'm not entirely sure.
And then, of course, once you figured it out, because it's a novel and it's still in process, you can go back and fix.
That's right, yeah.
Alexander Maksik, looking over, trying to find biographical material about you, I discovered, I mentioned this before we went on the air, that there's very, very little. You were born in L.A., spent the first
yes.
12 years of your life there?
Yeah, first 14 years of my life. Yeah.
And your parents are teachers?
Yes. Yeah.
Both of them?
Both of them, teachers and then administrators.
So as you were growing up, did you do a lot of reading?
I did, yeah. I grew up around books. My very first memories really always include books as object and as things to read.
Did you ever think about writing even before you
always.
Left L.A.?
Yeah. yeah. It always seemed like a viable possibility. I think because my parents both had so much respect for writers, they were the kinds of people who went and knocked on writers' doors, when we traveled. I mean, I know my dad wrote letters to writers, and so it was a thing that was, writers were sacred, literature and particularly fiction was sacred in our house.
And then you moved to Ketchum, Idaho, which most people go, Ketchum, what's that? But that's
yeah.
Sun Valley.
Yeah.
It's a very
right.
wealthy enclave.
Yes.
And a ski resort.
Yep.
And actually also a summer resort in the middle of Idaho.
And my dad became the headmaster of a school there called the community school. And my mom became the head of an elementary school.
And you said it was fun growing up there.
It was great. I mean, it was very liberating. The dangers of Los Angeles were suddenly no longer there. I had my first job when I was 14. I worked as a dishwasher in a Mexican restaurant, and I had a bike, and it stayed late until, 10:30 at night in the summer, and it was great once I got through sulking about having moved.
And then you went to college in Washington?
Yeah, Walla Walla, Whitman College. When I first got there, I was playing soccer, and the idea was that I'd be a soccer player, but I was always a wretched student. I just wanted to graduate. Later, I spent a year in Sydney, and when I came back, I had this notion that I wanted to be an actor, which was seriously misguided. They had a wonderful theater department there, and I spent a lot of time in the theater and met people that I probably would never have met otherwise. And
had you ever thought of writing plays?
I wrote a few plays in college, one acts and that kind of thing. But and then I did later. I went to the Williamstown Theater Festival in Massachusetts and was an apprentice, and then went back the following year and worked in the literary department there and wrote a bunch of plays.
And did you try being an actor when you were living in L.A.?
I did, yeah.
And were you in anything?
I was in G.I. Jane. I had no lines, but I got my SAG card because of G.I. Jane. And then I did a commercial for CVS Pharmacy in which I played an architect with a broken leg, and that was the end of my acting career.
But what took you to Paris?
I had fantasies of being a writer in Paris. I mean, I read, there's no way around it. It's just all of the cliches.
You've mentioned in an interview Movable Feast by Hemingway.
I mean, I read that, growing up in Ketchum, Hemingway lived there and worked there and killed himself there and is buried there, and there's a beautiful memorial. And I was sort of steeped in Hemingway stories, and I think, it was my junior or senior year in high school, and I read A Movable Feast and just thought, this is it. This is the life I want to live. And it was very much that kind of Hemingway life. It was never the boxing or the drinking or the lions. It was just, sitting around in Paris and talking to artists and smoking cigarettes and that whole scene.
Did you speak French at the time?
No, I didn't speak a word of French.
And when you got over there, did you speak French?
I learned to speak French, but when I first arrived, I didn't speak a word of French.
How'd you get a job as a teacher?
Well, I'd been working at an Orthodox Jewish school.
Are you Jewish?
I am Jewish, but not at all religious.
Right. Yeah.
And I was teaching at this Orthodox Jewish school and lost my job there because I taught a novel by the poet Naomi Shihab Nye, a young adult novel. It was a sort of Romeo and Juliet story called Habibi, in which Israeli soldiers are not portrayed particularly well, and it became this thing. I needed a new job, and I'd always wanted to live in Paris, and managed to get hired at a school there.
You became a high school teacher.
Yes.
How old were you?
I was 29 when I moved to Paris.
And you got involved with a student.
I did.
And how old was she?
She was 17 at the time. The fundamental plot points of that first novel, You Deserve Nothing, and mine are, obviously, it's no secret, they're quite similar. But nonetheless, it is very much a novel.
And did you get caught in real life?
I did, yeah.
And you were fired?
Yes.
And how long had you been there?
4 years.
4 years.
Yeah.
At that particular time, were you doing any other writing?
I was writing poems and pretty bad poems at that. And I was writing some short fiction, but not with any real enthusiasm and certainly without any real discipline. I had, I had these notions of being a writer without actually writing anything. And it was, as I've said, it's much easier to pretend to be a writer than it is to actually write anything.
After that, you began working on You Deserve Nothing while you were in Paris?
Yes.
Unemployed?
Unemployed. That's right. When I started writing, I was unemployed, and slowly, I wrote for various, I wrote travel articles, I wrote a guidebook, I was tutoring, and then I ended up teaching English at Berlitz. This is a spoon, this is a spoon, that kind of thing.
And what year was that? Really?
I would say 2007, 2008.
On IMDb, there's a short film called Saturday.
Yeah.
And you were in that.
Yes, I was.
What was that?
We have to talk about that. A good friend of mine, who's a musician and a filmmaker and a professor of film in Paris, he wrote this short, and he asked me to do it, and I was saying yes to everything at that time.
You're working on the novel, and mm-hmm. then you decided to come back to America?
I finished the novel and sent it out, and after a long time, a lot of rejections from agents, I was picked up by an agent, but he didn't sell the novel, and so I was sort of at loose ends, and I was really unhappy teaching at Berlitz, and I applied to Iowa because I didn't really know what else to do. I came home one night, and the phone rang, and they were offering me a fellowship there.
The novel, You Deserve Nothing. Mm-hmm. How do you feel now about the relationship between real life and fiction? The fact that you've taken your own life, mm-hmm. and of course, there you've got a guy who could easily be a villain in a novel,
sure.
and it's you.
I was never such a good teacher as the teacher in that book. I didn't have the following that teacher had. There are endless differences between the story of my life and the story in that novel. I think as a first novel, the idea of writing a novel was, it just seemed impossible to me. I had no idea if I could do it. And so I took something that was very difficult at the time, and I tried to turn it into fiction, which seemed like that seemed like the thing to do at the time.
So it was kind of a therapy almost to get you past.
Well, I mean, I don't know about a therapy, but it certainly helped me. It was cathartic. You know, it's funny, the novel, people, I know that some readers find him, the Will Silver, to be kind of unimpeachable at the end. But my attitude, the way I look at that book is that, you know, he's a total and complete failure. And he's pathetic and weak and is essentially a coward. It's the students in the novel who are brave and who evolve. The idea that it's read in a different way, that was the most surprising thing to me.
You go off to Iowa City, you've got this manuscript that's still making the rounds.
Oh, it had stopped.
How did it come alive again? How did it wind up with Alice Siebold?
Europa Editions, which is a wonderful press, they started this imprint called Tonga Books, and they sent out a press release, and the press release described essentially my novel. This is what we're looking for. My agent sent it to Alice, and 24 hours later, 48 hours later, she bought it. And then, you know, within the next 2 weeks, we sold foreign rights to 11 different countries, and suddenly the book was to be published in less than a year.
Why do you think it failed the first time?
I really don't know. One guess is that it's morally ambiguous. It doesn't make a claim one way or the other about who is good and who is bad in the book. You know, relationships between teachers and students. I honestly don't know. And it's very difficult for me to sort of talk about my own book and guess. You know, there was a lot of enthusiasm in those rejections. There were younger editors who wanted it, but the senior editors were not convinced. And we started with the biggest publishers and worked our way all the way to the smallest publishers, and not a single one bought it. You know, and it went on to do pretty well.
Alexander Maksik, so you go to Iowa City and you're teaching there.
Oh, I didn't teach my first year there.
And is that where you met Alan Gerganis?
Yes, yeah, in my last year at Iowa, as a student at Iowa, yeah.
Did you also work with people like Marilyn Robinson?
I did, yeah. She was a workshop professor.
Okay, anyone else?
Ethan Kanan.
I know Ethan. Yeah,
yeah. Michelle Hunnevin.
That transformed you as a writer.
It did. I mean, just being taken seriously. I know there's so much criticism of workshops, and particularly of Iowa. And I arrived with a chip on my shoulder. I was older than a lot of the students there. I had no sense of myself as a writer, no sense of myself as a student, other than that, you know, a long history of being really bad at being a student. But to be suddenly treated as if what I was doing was serious, and to be given money and time, I got to write every day, and I was so hungry. And I worked really, really hard when I was there. And just the discussion of writing, it's in the air there. You can't escape it. You either talk about writing or you talk about football. I loved that. And in retrospect, I see how powerful an experience it was and how much I learned. But I learned as much from my, you know, from my classmates as I did from my professors, to be honest.
One more question. How did you wind up writing parts of this book in Estonia?
Well, I discovered I like to travel using residencies, and I found this place on a farm in Estonia. It's called the Palitalu Arts Center, and they took me, and I went, and I spent a month on this farm. I wrote there, and I don't know, you know, I love to travel, and I love to travel that way.
A Jewish guy in Estonia, was there any anti-Semitism that you saw there?
I didn't see any, no.
Okay.
No, not at all.
Right. Because it's pretty notorious in the Baltic states.
Right. Yeah, no, it was really a completely lovely experience. The woman who runs it was fantastic, and I wrote a huge amount of this book there.
Getting back to something we talked about very early on mm-hmm. in the interview, the immigrant experience. Your own life has been very much as not an immigrant, but as an expat.
Yeah, that's true.
Do you think living in those different countries gives you some kind of an appreciation for the immigrant experience that most people don't have?
Absolutely an appreciation. I'm very careful not to compare my experience with the experience of, you know, some of the people I'm writing about. But yes, to come to Paris having not any French, and to go through the experience of, you know, getting a carte séjour and trying to rent an apartment and to do all of that, it's a difficult thing. It's not, you know, within the larger context of difficulty, it's nothing. But it's Paris, exactly. And I'm not in any way complaining, but I was very much aware of being a foreigner. And I think just that awareness, and it's not, you know, not only in Paris, I travel quite a bit, and traveling alone, I think, is also, and doing all of this alone. I didn't move to Paris with anyone. I went by myself, and I think that compounds the experience of being separated and watching. You have to be so alert because you're trying to learn not only a language, but a culture. And you learn mannerisms, and you learn attitudes, and you learn the way that, you know, one needs to be when you enter a store, you enter a restaurant, and so on. And
that fully informs Jacqueline.
Absolutely.
In a
yeah.
marker to measure draft.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is. You know, there's a level of theater to it, and you have to play a part.
Jacqueline choosing to play the part of, say, a masseur on the beach.
Yeah.
Is, in a way, the kinds of things that you were dealing with, her observations mm-hmm. transformed. I mean, that's Greek society,
yeah.
but it's the same thing as you doing it in Estonia, in Greece,
yeah.
or in Paris.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's something that I find really, really interesting. I I'd never been so conscious of that, the theatrical aspect of joining a culture other than my own. Because whatever I know about being American, whatever that means, you know, I didn't know about being French or being Italian or being Estonian or whatever the culture was. It's exciting. And if you have privilege, it can be fun to learn those things and to adapt and be accepted. And, you know, you learn the magic codes.
If you have privilege.
If you have privilege, absolutely. I was more interested in the people without privilege, you know, and particularly because the French, to make a sweeping generalization, do not treat foreigners, particularly foreigners who are without privilege, very well. And, you know, and that's not particular to France. I mean, all across Western Europe, you know, immigrants are being treated badly, and you know, we're seeing the effects of that.
Alexander Maksik, right now you're working on a collection of short stories?
I don't know about that. I think I'm finished. I may be finished with a collection of short stories, but I'm working on a novel as well. Yeah.
Is it easier post-Gurganis to write short stories?
It's not easy to write short stories. I enjoy it. I enjoy it more maybe than I did, you know, 5 years ago, but I don't find it easy at all.
And your novel you're not going to talk about?
No. I don't even know really what it is yet.
Have you gotten any interest from Hollywood on either of these two books?
Yes, not on this book. I hope I'm wrong, but I worry that this book, A Marker to Measure Drift, is unfilmable. But the first book, I've just received an option offer a few days ago. So with the idea that it'll be shot next year. Whether or not that happens is not for me to say.
You've been listening to an interview with Alexander Maksik, whose latest novel is A Marker to Measure Drift. The earlier novel was titled You Deserve Nothing. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.